Hi, and welcome to the Tough Fish Show. I'm your host, Jen Melius, and I'm so glad that you're here. And before we get into the show, I've got two resources for you if you're ready to take those next steps of visibility and sharing. The Author Stylist Guide is my new book that is your toolbox for the steps to make the most of speaking engagements, book signings, and podcast interviews when they arise, so you grow your readership and create a buzz about your catalog of work and message. And it's available where books are sold. The second are free resources focused on helping you get your book and message out into the world. Visit jennifermelius.com/start and choose what resonates. And whether you grab these resources or the new book, both are about helping you take steps forward to be seen and heard, to show up at the table, own your space, share your book and message. And now let me introduce to you Mary Camarillo. Mary Camarillo is the author of the award-winning novels Those People Behind Us and The Lockhart Women. Her awards include the 2022 Indie Author Project Award for California Adult Fiction, the 2022 Willa Literary Award finalist in Multiform Fiction, and the 2021 First Place Award in the Next Generation Indies for First Fiction. She currently serves on the advisory boards of Citric Acid, an Orange County Literary Arts Quarterly, and Libro Mobile, an arts cooperative and bookstore in Santa Ana, California. Mary lives in Huntington Beach, California with her husband, who plays ukulele, and their terrorist cat, Riley, who makes frequent appearances on Instagram. Let's dive into the pond and meet Mary. Welcome to the Tough Fish Show. I am so excited to bring to you Mary Camarillo. Mary, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to talk to you.
I am so glad you are here. And I would love for you to start, apparently, with my favorite question. How did you get into writing?
Well, I was one of those kids that went to the library and checked out every single book and read them as quickly as I can and went back for more. I think my whole life I've been a student of stories and an avid reader of fiction. So in high school, I wrote poetry, pretty bad poetry. I edited the literary magazine in high school, and I thought about a career in journalism, but I unfortunately let a sour teacher kind of turn me off of that idea. I graduated in 1970. The economy was not so great then. I had just witnessed my aerospace engineer father lose his job and his pension. So it seemed to me like the best thing to do would be to get a job and try to start supporting myself. So I went to work for the post office. It might be hereditary. I had two grandfathers that were railway postal clerks, but I really didn't plan on staying there and making a career out of it. I thought I would work a while and then quit and travel because that was what I really loved to do in those days. And I still love to do that. But I quickly learned that the Postal Service offers 5 weeks of vacation eventually, and there's 10 paid holidays to take advantage of. They also have a great pension, which I'm still taking advantage of. I met lifelong friends. I met my husband there, and I discovered that there were a lot of different jobs you could do there. So I started out, you know, sorting mail and selling stamps. I know you're starting to think, what does this have to do with writing? But I made my way into the accounting office and I went back to school and got a business degree. And 15 years before I retired, I was an audit manager for the Office of Inspector General, which meant that I wrote and edited countless audit reports about things that were wrong at the post office. And I started thinking, because I'm still, you know, a lifelong reader of fiction, I'm still thinking, wow, these are still stories. You know, there are stories about things that are wrong. And that's my favorite kind of novel, is somebody that has problems. And an audit report, and don't worry, I'm not going to give you a lesson on auditing, but an audit report, it's required to say, what's the cause of this bad condition? Mm-hmm. And who the heck cares? What's the effect of it? Mm-hmm. And I think that's really true in fiction too. I think we want to understand why people are like they are, which is one of the reasons I write. And we want to care about them. And I think audit reports are, of course, supposed to be true, but good fiction needs to feel like the truth. But fiction is a lot more fun to write. So I'm happy to be writing fiction now.
Okay, so I love the fact that you took technical writing and essentially a form of a technical background with what you're talking about, because it's not like you can, there is some wiggle room. It sounds like you're able to how you put it together, but you can't, make up other pieces. You have to take those existing elements and put it together like a puzzle of sorts to say, this is all the information, all the data that I have, and let me paint you the picture of what happened to create the problem that we're in, and thus auditing or the results that the audit are showing. So I love that you talk about that. Now, what I'm curious is, technical writing has a different, it's still writing, but it feels a little different than a creative writing of sorts. So how was that shift for you to kind of go from, when you're writing technical, and then wanting to weave in those pieces that help you to feel like you're telling that story, and actually shifting into writing fiction itself, like where you don't have those limitations.
I think limitations are kind of helpful,
They can be.
to put like a little box around something and say, like one time I tried to write a story on a typewriter that didn't have the key E. So I had to think of words that didn't use the key. It was almost impossible. But I think those restrictions are kind of helpful. People sometimes say my prose is pretty crisp, and that probably comes from the technical background that I have. But maybe I was never really that good of an audit writer because I think I really had to constrain myself, sometimes to not put all the cool details in, So, yeah, and all along I've been reading fiction and trying to learn from it. So,
So, what are some things that you did to help get your first novel going? For instance, you had some vacation time or some other days that could be taken. Did you start to see where, yes, I have this career, but I want to explore this other side, this love that I've had all along, and start to shift that
Yeah.
way? So you use the time a little bit differently. And then what helped you to kind of transition to say, I really want to see, what I can make of this draft, this manuscript that ultimately became a book that you published?
The first thing I did was I tried to write stories about my husband's family because they have, I'm fascinating. It's a big family, there's a lot of drama. So I wanted to capture some of that. So I took some classes. Bowers Museum had a writing class. UC Irvine had a writing class. Just, one day, maybe 6 week classes that kind of gave me the idea of how to frame stories and maybe get over my audit background a little bit. But then I realized that I would really rather make stuff up than write somebody's history. So I started writing short stories. And I have realized I'm honestly not a very good short story writer because I don't know where to end them. And that's what's happened with my two books. They both started off as short stories that just wanted to be novels. I just had characters that would not leave me alone and wanted to keep the story going. So, but it's been really helpful to take advantage of community colleges here. There's a really good Irvine Valley College here has incredible professor Lisa Alvarez, who's just instrumental in teaching me how to tell stories. Through her, I learned about the community of writers up in the High Sierras, and I got to go to that writing conference a long time ago. That was incredible. It kind of showed me that I didn't really know what I was doing, so it was kind of humbling. There's a writer, novelist, short story writer, Richard Bosch, who runs an incredibly generous community workshop out of Chapman University. So I took advantage of that. So I just started looking for opportunities. How can I learn more? And I'm still looking for the opportunities and how to learn more. I think that's what's so exciting about this path is, just trying to get better all the time.
I love that. So when you were working on this first manuscript, you realized, oh, there's more stuff that, like you were saying earlier, like I didn't realize I need to, there's stuff I need to be doing, or how do I make this better? How did you start to work through that manuscript? Because so many times I hear writers talk about, okay, well, maybe I have that draft, or I think I've got it going. I worked through the middle section that's a little maybe clunky for me, but I got through it. And then I got an ending. Great. I get to go back through it. And yes, they might be excited in a sense because now you have something to work with. But sometimes when you're looking at that full manuscript and you're going, okay, how do I really look at this differently? How do I pick it apart to understand what do I need to do with it? Did you run into that and how did you work through it?
Absolutely. I'm not the kind of writer that starts out with an outline. I have no idea where I'm going with the story. I kind of write by the seat of my pants. I'm definitely a pantser. So I start out with character and then I'm always in search of a plot, you know? So these characters, I eventually come up with a cast of them and they start bumping into each other. And I think, what kind of problems are they going to have and how are they going to resolve them? Which means that I end up with a lot of words that doesn't really necessarily have a through line, you know? That's one thing I learned. I went to the Napa Writers Conference, which is super fun if you like wine. And there's some incredible professors there. Lan Chang told me that, Mary, you need to learn about plot, about a through line. Like, you're not this, you've got all these little snippets, but they've got to carry through. You've got to find some way to bring them all together. So that was, it's not an easy thing to learn. I'm not afraid to cut though and delete, and I love revision. That's my favorite thing.
So how do you know then when you, for instance, you might have thought you had said through line, and it's one thing for someone else to say, you need this or this is missing. But if you were the one going back through the edits, or going back through your manuscript going, great, I have this feedback. Okay.
Now what?
How do I do this? Because I don't technically know that I understand what I've heard, how did you break that down to turn it into something actionable for you?
Well, my first novel, The Lockhart Women, took 6 years. So it was a lot of getting other people's feedback and listening to some of it and completely discarding a lot of it because you can't write a novel by committee. You have to start trusting your own voice. So trial and error, I started thinking, well, that doesn't sound right, but this feels right to me. It's really more of a feeling. And I think finally you get to a place where things start clicking together and you think, this feels solid. Like I can see this makes sense. It's still a little bit surprising, but it feels satisfying. So that's what I'm looking for.
So when you are going through that process, and to your point earlier, you're not afraid to cut words or characters or scenes, or what helps you to decide that that does need to be cut or it can stay? For instance, if it seems like it's a little questionable, what helps it to be able to stay? I mean, sometimes it's really obvious it needs to go. You have this rogue character who might be pretty cool, but they're just not adding to the plot, and you know it, and you can easily see that. But then there are other times when it feels like, oh, but I really do like this part a little bit more, and I really can figure, I know I can make it work. And it is your prerogative to certainly try to do that, and you might be able to, but then you might also come back to it going, no, oh, parting is such sweet sorrow. And so, how do you make that decision when you're sitting there going, it's so close, or I really do like this?
It sounds like you would be a really good editor for me.
I
One thing that one workshop person told me said, she said, how are you justifying these words? Like, why does the story need to be this long? And at first I was like, well, of course, all those words, they're all justified. I guess it does it add, does it move the story forward? At the end of the day, are you going to miss this? Is the story going to fall apart if this is not in there? Like with those people behind us, I had a whole writing group. I love writing about writing groups. The real estate character is writing a novel. Well, yeah, it was really fun to talk about the writing group, but they didn't really have anything to do with the story. So I cut that fairly late in the process. I guess it's just making sure every scene and every chapter moves forward somehow.
Very cool. Very, very cool. So to your point, you have two novels out. The first novel comes out and you've been doing all the things to talk about it. You're excited about it. This piece has finally seen the light of day. It's out there, you're excited, and you start working on book two. Or you might have been working a little bit on book two, but how did you come through what has been talked about on and off on this show before as second book syndrome, where, oh my goodness, will the second book be, can I still write the way I did on the first book? Will it be as good? Will it be better? Or how do I know I've still got it in me kind of thing? How did you come through that so that you would have book two?
Well, as you know, getting a book out in the world takes a really long time. Like I signed with She Writes Press, and my book came out like 18 months later. And there's a ton of work to do on the book in during that period of time. But you do need to start something new, so you'll have something different to think about. So, but then a lot of people, the early readers and then early, book purchasers were like, "Oh, I love this book. Is the second one going to be a sequel?" It's like, no, that's not really what I had in mind. I'd already started working on something else. The other challenging thing about my first book was it was a pandemic. So, I like how you said that I was ready to talk about it. I was not actually ready to talk about it. I was super naive
Oh.
when I published my first book, thinking I could just say, here, read it. I didn't know about elevator pitches and being able to summarize themes and promoting myself. And honestly, during that, it was kind of the mid-pandemic, so I wasn't doing bookstore events. I was doing Zoom events. By then, people were fairly sick of Zoom, so I really don't think I got a lot of experience talking about the book and what it meant. And I'm just so having so much more fun with the second book because I've done a lot of bookstore events. I've gone to book clubs and like talked to people that have actually read the book and are super excited about all the characters. So it's been a completely different experience for me. But I'm
Nice.
starting to work on book three now. And people are saying, "Oh, is it going to be a sequel?" Well, no. I don't think so.
So let's talk about that. There's a couple things there that you just really captivated my attention. You had people coming up to you and saying, "I love that character," or "I love that this happened," or what have you. What was that like?
It's amazing. I mean, these are things that I've invented in my own little head in my own little office that, now people are talking about them like they're real people. I just love that. I mean, I find that so exciting.
Very
Now,
cool.
my characters are not always likable, and I hear that a lot too. Like, I would not want to go to lunch with this person. I'm glad this person doesn't live in my neighborhood. I think my characters are very human, but they're not necessarily the ones you want to be best friends with. And I'm okay with that.
But I agree with you. I think that if you have characters that they need to have humanity. They need to be, and that's what makes them relatable. They don't have to be likable. They'd have to You believable in a sense. You have to have some element of this is going to actually, this character feels real enough where you get them, but you don't have to like them. In fact, there are some characters you don't want to like, and it's intentional. So you need them, and you need them to be pretty strong too, in a lot of cases, because, if you have this protagonist who has everything going hunky dory, and then you are deliberately have this antagonist coming along, they need to match the protagonist to be a threat or to be, a source of tension and conflict. If they're not that strong, then it's like, okay. We don't need to worry about you.
They have to be multidimensional, right? Like, I don't think
Yes.
there's a few examples in history of true villains, but I think most people have some kind of redeeming quality. They're nice to their mother, or they take really good care of their dog, or I don't know, they go to the wetlands and pick up trash or whatever. I mean, most people have something about them that's redeemable.
Yes, I agree. And I think that when you plant that seed about, especially your antagonist, your villain in the book or what have you, you create a little bit more dimension, like you're saying, and you can almost help to create them a little bit more gray, because in some cases you might go, because you've planted that seed so well, then it's, well, how might they actually respond? Could they respond a little differently in another situation because of that? And that kind of makes it a little bit more interesting too at times, because this character might look at you going, I'm not going to do that. Or I
They
would,
do that all the
right.
time.
It's like they talk back to you and it's like,
Yeah.
no, we need to have this relationship where you're talking to me so I can help your story. And they're like, no, I have it. Just follow me.
That's why both my books are multi points of view books. Like The Lockhart Women has three women. Those People Behind Us has five characters. I know it sounds like a lot, but I love stories where you get to see characters in different environments and bumping up against different people because I think it helps you understand them more. You see them in different environments and you see other people's reactions to them. And then you think, oh, that person actually, in this situation, they seem like they're pretty intelligent and functional and rational. Whereas when that scene that she just had with her daughter, you think, oh my God, what is wrong with this woman?
So actually, you just said something that I love that because you have multiple points of view happening, how did you keep them all straight? Especially when you went from three to five, like how did you keep all those kids straight
Yeah.
so that everybody was making sense? They were, when they intersected, it made sense, but you didn't lose them throughout the book. How did you keep it all straight?
And it was a challenge for me and those people behind us because they're all different ages too. Like I've got teenagers up to 80-year-olds. So the important thing is their voices. Like I learned with the Lockhart women, I needed to start reading out loud all the time just to make sure that it sounded like something the character would actually say and think. And my husband thinks I'm crazy. Like he thinks I'm talking to somebody upstairs, but it's really important to read out loud. You kind of have to make a little list of like, how old is this character and what color is their hair and do they always have the same hair color? And yeah, little things like that are important. But yeah, the voice is really critical to me. Does it sound realistic? That's where early readers are very helpful too.
Yeah, very much so. Very, very much so. So, to your point earlier about being a pantser, so we've pantsed this book. You've got a draft. Do you go back and start to like work an outline or kind of some sort of spreadsheet almost that says, here's all these characters, here's where they're showing up, and here's their
Yeah.
different dynamics? Because that might have happened for somebody who might be, plotting the book. But when you're pantsing, do you go back through and kind of weave in some of that structure for yourself? To
Yeah.
kind of basically
I
check
think
yourself.
plotting sounds so much more efficient. I just admire someone that can do that. Yeah, definitely by the end. And it's really helpful to me. We're talking about setting boundaries. With both of these books, I set timelines. And that's kind of like imposing, not really a plot, but a structure around it. Like with the Lockhart women, it starts on the night of the O.J. Simpson chase through Los Angeles. It's not about Simpson. It's about a woman who gets hooked on watching the trial. So that book follows the trajectories of all three trials. So there's a frame, like this has to happen because that's what was happening with the trial. With Those People Behind Us, it's set in the summer of 2017. So it starts right at the beginning of May and goes through the end of summer. So a lot has to happen with these five characters, but it's helpful to me to know, okay, that can happen because that would have taken too long. So cut that scene, this makes more sense. Imposing like a structure like that is super helpful to someone like me that it's
Yeah.
just pulling things out of thin air and hoping they stick together.
Right. Because to me, what I'm hearing is when you're pantsing and you've written the book out completely and then you're going back through, that's what I was envisioning, some kind of in the editing process, a structure that you're starting to put in to go, okay, I need to see, are my characters evenly balanced throughout the book
Right.
as they
Yeah.
should be? Have I run a little tally to see that? Or am I, showing these relationships well enough? Are they flowing as they should be? To your point, if we're starting at Memorial Day and we're ending at Labor Day, that is my framework. And if there's something that's going on that's going to go outside of that window, can it get adjusted to make sense? Or is it a sorry, kids, this is not
Yeah.
happening in this book this time?
Yeah, exactly. Like Those People Behind Us, there's a housing project that's going into a neighborhood. And I really had to think about that a lot because how long does it take to tear down a building and start building a new one? I had to do a lot of construction research to make sure that was going to work.
Yeah, and that's what I'm hearing. Like the boundaries that you gave yourself actually helped to create a little bit of the playroom to be able to pants, but then kind of rein it in, going, nope, we don't have this. So, okay, I gotta navigate this. And whether or not you had those boundaries clearly defined at the get-go, or they took shape through the editing process, then, it sounds to me like they were blending together like that.
Yeah, it makes it sound so much more intentional than it actually was, but I like that. But yeah, I do like the restrictions. I love like writing prompts where they say write about a Ford Mustang and your favorite vegetable and a song from the 80s, and put all that together and come up with a story, I love little restrictions like that because it makes your brain work in a different way.
I really appreciate you saying that because, sometimes when you think about the creativity of being a writer, where you can do all kinds of different things, unless you've created a world that you're trying to stick within or certain rules that you're trying to stick within, you can kind of play with what you need to. I mean, there are rules to follow or rules that you're working with, but a lot of times when you're starting, it's your imagination and what it can create, and there aren't any boundaries.
Yeah, and that can be kind of that can give you writer's block, I think, if you think I could just write about anything and anyone and any place I want to in the whole world. So what am I going to write about? I mean, I need some kind of let's pull that down a little bit, let's write about this thing.
Very cool. So, what would you say to a writer who might be kind of resisting the idea of setting boundaries, may or setting some restrictions, as you were calling them?
Yeah.
What would you say to that person to maybe see if they might change their mind or open up to that idea?
Well, first of all, writing advice doesn't work for everybody. This might not work for you, but I would say try it. I would say, I mean, there's a ton of books that have really good writing prompts that at first, my first reaction is usually, oh my God, how would you ever write about that? And those are the ones I try to zero in on and just give it a try. I mean, you might just get one sentence that you can run with. You might spend, 15, 20 minutes going, this is a waste of time, but what about this one line? So sometimes those little kernels can like explode into something else that's much bigger.
Very cool. Very cool. Mary, this has been awesome. Where can
Yeah.
people connect with you and where can they get your books?
Well, my website is the same as my name, marycamarillo.com. I have a newsletter that you can sign up for there. It's called Life with Riley, who is my manager of marketing. My books are available everywhere. Anywhere you like to buy books, Amazon, Bookshop, you can order them online. I have audiobooks and ebooks and paperbacks, and I'd love to hear what anybody thinks. So let me know.
Thank you so much. This has been so much fun.
It was fun.
I'm a big believer that if the story came to you, it must come through you. If you're in the middle of the first draft, keep writing. If you're in the middle of edits, keep refining. No matter where you are, but especially if you've hit published, keep talking about and sharing your book and message. If you're ready to take those next steps of visibility and sharing, I've got two opportunities for you. The Author Stylist Guide is your toolbox for the next steps to make the most of speaking engagements, book signings, and podcast interviews when they arise, so you grow your readership and create a buzz about your catalog of work and message. Visit jennifermillias.com/books to learn more and hop on the wait list and pre-order today. Or if one-on-one, high-touch support to get you, your business, your book, your brand, your message to that next big level for you is what you need, visit jennifermillias.com/stylist to see if this is perfect for where you are now. And if yes, book a complimentary consult call and let's talk. Thanks again for listening today. I'm so glad you are here. Your book, your message, your body of work is worth sharing, and you are the right person and the only one who can share it. The people who need to hear your message the most are waiting for you. They are waiting for you to step up to your next level of genius so they can have the impact they're meant to because you inspired them. I'll see you soon.